Welcome, everyone. Thanks very much for being here. My name's Eliza Canty Jones. I work at the Oregon Historical Society. The Oregon Historical Society is really honored to host tonight's program, and we're really eager to hear from all our panelists about the history that they share in the It Did Happen Here podcast and the work of creating that. Our program tonight obviously is virtual, but I am coming to you from my home in Southeast Portland. Portland is located on the lands of the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Walala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Columbia River. We always like to take a moment at the beginning of our programs to think about the fact that we're on indigenous land, no matter where we are in Oregon, wherever we are in the United States. We're on a land that has been peopled for thousands and thousands of years since time immemorial. And the indigenous people of this place continue to have deep and forever relationships with the land and the plants and the animals here. So we encourage you, wherever you are, to learn about the indigenous peoples whose land you live on and work on and play on, and to go directly to those sources to learn about those histories and cultures. The Oregon Historical Society, our mission is to preserve our state's history and make it accessible to everyone in ways that advance knowledge and inspire curiosity about all the peoples, places, and events that have shaped Oregon. And we're going to hear a lot about some of those significant people and events tonight. So we're really grateful to have the partnership with KBOO and with the It Did Happen Here podcast. So the way it's going to go tonight, we have four panelists. I'll read out an introduction just so you can learn a little bit about each of them. And then I have a bunch of questions that we have created together before this, and I'll begin sharing those out. One of our panelists, we wanna let folks know, will not have their camera on. So occasionally you'll hear China's voice, but not see China's face. And we just wanna let you know that's on purpose. So keep your ears out for that voice when she's speaking. Thanks to all of our panelists for agreeing to take the time to do this program tonight. And thanks for the podcast. I'm a huge fan and I'm really excited to see more and more people get to know this work. And just thinking about the fact that journalists and historians in the future are gonna be referring to this podcast to understand so much about this place where we live. So first and foremost, thank you all very much for doing this work. So our panelists tonight include China, who is a dedicated activist, community organizer, doula, and educator. She has extensive background in community organizing as the founder and executive director of Muslims United, a nonprofit that makes space for Muslim women's leadership, as well as the Hidayah Women's Resource and Advocacy Project, an advocacy program for Muslim survivors of violence. She has worked as a science instruction and curriculum developer at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, otherwise known as OMSI, and as a science teacher at the Islamic School of Portland. China attended the historically Black Tuskegee University and went on to earn her BS in biology at Portland State University. As a teenager, she found herself fighting fascism on the streets of Portland. She opens the It Did Happen Here podcast with her experience of being attacked by racist skinheads at a Portland punk show for being a Black punk girl. Michael "Mike" Crenshaw is a Chicago-born independent hip-hop artist, respected MC, poet, educator, and activist currently residing in Portland, Oregon. He was a founding member of the Minneapolis Baldies and Anti-Racist Action. He has released dozens of albums and collaborated with Immortal Technique, Dead Prez, Soul, and others. Crenshaw is the lead US organizer for the African Hip-Hop Caravan and uses cultural activism as a means to develop international solidarity around human rights and justice through hip hop and education. Mike is also the Northwest Regional Director of Hip Hop Congress and facilitates the hip hop cultural exchange projects globally. He was one of the co-hosts, producers, scriptwriters, and music curators for the It Did Happen Here podcast. Selena Flores is a photographer and podcast producer living in Portland, Oregon. Her documentary work includes a series of COVID portraits and technical operations for live radio. Flores will continue the work of collaborating with a team to create media that educates in an engaging manner while shining a light on the racist history of the United States in the hopes of one day achieving a reckoning for the injustices of the powerful against those they continue to oppress. Flores was the director of operations, one of the co-hosts, producers, and fact checkers for the It Did Happen Here podcast. Erin Yankee is a documentarian. She works in the mediums of audio, print, and video. Her work focuses on themes of the unheard story, how place can shape a life, comparative experience across identities, and the importance of the clean and sharp edit. Her many projects include over 20 years of radio production, audio zines, self-published magazines, audiobooks, quite a few demo tapes, and a few pieces of vinyl. Erin was one of the scriptwriters, editors, and music curators for the It Did Happen Here podcast and served as executive director. So thanks again to our panel. And I want to throw out our first question to Mike and China, the folks who participated in the history that the It Did Happen Here podcast documents and analyzes. I want to ask you both what it was like to revisit this part of your life, both in being interviewed for the podcast, in doing interviews for the podcast, and then in listening to it. Did it change how you thought about that time in your life at all? Is there anything you want to say about how the project has impacted your health and well-being? So there's a few questions to start with. How about it?
Welcome, everybody, and thank you for being here. And I was living a life as a teenager and a younger man where my commitment to anti-fascist organizing and street fighting against neo-Nazis really defined my identity, in the sense that a lot of the struggles that I was going through as a child and finding names for the things that I was struggling through, against, and with happened in that window of time in which I was a teenager, becoming a self-determined human being. For all the different events and people and circumstances that intersected, I found myself amongst a group of friends in Minneapolis who were multi-ethnic, who were in the hardcore punk scene, and who were skinheads. We decided, you know, that the skinhead subculture, the style, the music, the attitude was something that spoke to who we were trying to become. And it just so happened that at the same time we were finding our identity in that subcultural movement, there was a lot of mainstream media attention being given to neo-Nazis that were calling themselves skinheads. So immediately there was a contradiction. Me being a Black kid, seeing that, it was apparent to me that I had to do something about it. I couldn't consciously coexist in a scene and in an environment where neo-Nazis were trying to assert themselves. I, you know, growing up as a Black kid, reading stories about the Klan, understanding the racial terror and lynching that was so much a part of the history of this country, and understanding that people like me were the target of that terror, there was no way I was gonna accept that. And the fact that I had a group of friends who felt similarly really became the defining aspect of who we were and who I became. So that said, when I hear the podcast, the process of going out and interviewing people that I grew up with, that I fought in the streets and sacrificed with and shed blood with and grew to love, it, to me, it's one of the most affirming things that I've ever experienced in life. Not only was the initial period of commitment and involvement affirming, but after all these decades, to have time to come back as a middle-aged person, to reach back out to a lot of these people, and to find this kind of collective shared impetus to really expose why we did what we did is huge, because it lets me know that I'm not alone. I wasn't alone then, and I'm not alone now, you know? And so to have the team, Selena and Aaron and Icky and Mo Baustern, who were, you know, helping us create the narrative aspects, we've really been able to do something as a team that none of us could have done alone. And so in our own way, I feel like we've been very successful in paying homage to the previous efforts and bringing the previous efforts of those of us who were fighting in the streets and organizing into a light that currently is relevant. You know, I just feel like it's a gift. And so I'm really proud of it. And I'm happy that it's happened. You know, somebody like China. So, you know, I remember when I first came to Portland, I was immediately struck by China because she was one of the only other Black people in the hardcore punk scene. And even though China wasn't a skinhead, China was very powerful in her stance. And so I immediately was like, that's my person. She's us, she's me. And so after all these years, for us to be able to come together in the context of it did happen here and let our voices be heard, I feel like it's a gift.
China, if you and the folks on our back end, Issa and Sarah, who are our OHS support staff, if you all want to try and work in the chat to try and see if there's something you can do to make sure we can hear your voice. Well, while she's working on that, I actually wanted to toss that question, Aaron and Selena, to you all as well. If you wanted to speak a little bit about, just like from an emotional standpoint, what it was like to work on this. You know, we can talk about the technical things or, you know, why and how you decided to do it, but sort of, were there ways in which working on this podcast and learning in this history changed you? How did it make you feel and what was it like? What was it like at the end that was different from the beginning, you know?
For me, it was interesting because I was mentioning this to Mike earlier, actually, that going into this project, I didn't have kind of a full scope of what the story would be. And I started researching the people who were in the CHD and contacting them and had a list of interview questions and did a bunch of interviews. So I was only getting these kind of snapshots of the whole project. And it wasn't until we were recording the narration that I actually was able to see the full scope of the project. And it dawned on me how much it covered, and not to toot our horns, but that we did a really great job. I guess that is tooting our horns, but it kind of was like this synthesis of everyone's work that came together, and it was just really fulfilling to work on. It was a project that has become very close to my heart. I'm definitely passionate about racial justice, and also it was very educational to learn about the history of Portland. So yeah, it's been just the word fulfilling comes to mind for me.
I was a punk rocker in a different scene when I heard about the murder of Mulugeta Sarah, and it really, you know, had that scene didn't have it was a pretty small town, so it didn't have a skinhead problem. The way that scenes, like the place where I had moved from, had a bad skinhead problem that I lived in the year before, and being close to the Bay Area and the punk scenes, they'd had very much a skinhead problem during this whole era. And so just hearing about it was just like this, you know, gut punch, like we need to do something, we have to do something. And it's just been a thing that's kind of been part of my consciousness of like, I'm moving to Portland. I'm moving to a place where this happened. I'm moving to a place where the scene has dealt with and is dealing with this at the time that I moved here at the end of it. And when I came here, the skinhead violence on the street wasn't as visible as it was during this era. But it was just something that I feel like it was one of those important stories that everyone that lives here should know. And meeting Mike and knowing his connection to the Baldies and becoming friends over all the years, and then having this opportunity arise through different circumstances, and getting to make it and having this dream team to do it, and all the parts were there, getting it done, it just feels like a relief, like that we really did it right. I feel also very proud that we did this and proud that we did it right. And just wanted to also spotlight Mo Baustern and Icky A. They were part of our production team. Julie Perini also did a lot of the visual finding, but Mo and Icky really spent a lot of time with the narration. Icky lived here at the time. Mo lived in Chicago, was punk adjacent. So it was a great mix of people who were present and could really describe it from their own experiences, and people who were like, I was going through the same thing in a different town, so I had that kind of perspective. Selena didn't know about it from that being around in that time period, so could really see the things that we were too close to see. So it was just a lot of different skill sets coming together and making, being able to make this possible.
Hi, you guys, can you hear me?
By any chance? Yeah, okay. We can hear you great. Thanks, China.
Okay. My apologies. My computer, so I've joined via my phone. And so my apologies to you guys for just popping in late. And Mike, thanks for going first. It's just, I haven't really been on a Zoom call with this many people, so I appreciate that. And, you know, everything you said, Mike, I just totally resonates with me, for sure. And, I mean, our experience is different, but at the same time, there's a lot of similarities. So, I mean, I grew up here in Portland, Oregon, born and raised here, born at Emmanuel Hospital. And, you know, when I was contacted to do the, to come and talk at KBOO, I was kind of like, wow, somebody knows about this. This, you know, it was, I mean, I almost hate to admit it, but it was validating, like, wow, this meant something, because it meant a lot to me, and I knew what it meant, but that somebody, there was a, you know, a lot of people that were also involved, and that what we did affected, was, I guess it was like touching, like you kind of just kind of, that part of my life I'd kind of pushed away, because it was tough, and it was, you know, I mean, I was there, like I said, out of necessity. And I mean, I was naturally drawn to the punk rock skinhead scene because of the music that I liked. I came from a working class background and, you know, just identified with the movement. And my mom had, you know, someone that had a lot of, you know, she had at one point been a part of the Communist Worker Party. So she kind of, I wasn't raised as a communist, but she definitely raised me with the value system, some of the value system there. So I was, you know, immediate, I had a sense of what was right and wrong. And a lot of the punk rockers and stuff, they were into just kind of partying and doing whatever. And I saw the skinheads were a little bit more organized and kind of more focused. And that definitely resonated with me. But, and I think at the point, you know, like I was a punk rocker, not a skinhead, is like, it came down to, do I want to shave my head? I actually did have a fringe at one time, but I always identified with being punk rock and not a skinhead because it came down to some ideological points. I don't know, as a teenager, I think I've thought of anarchy and chaos instead of, you know, order and militancy, which is kind of what I think of as like the skinhead movement. But anyway, that was a long time ago. So I think that, and doing this podcast brought up a lot of things for me. And I'd been kind of working on a book. I am working on a book, but it's hard to write about these things. I saw some other people had written, people that were just kind of historians had written. And I was immediately like, wait, you guys weren't even there. Like, what are you saying? I mean, these are some other book that came out about, you know, Mulugeta Sarah. And that was such a, you know, it was such a massive turning point in my life, really, when we'd been fighting these Nazis and kind of, you know, we didn't even know if it was real, but then when Mulugeta Sarah was killed, we knew that it was real. So this pod, I'm very happy that you guys did the podcast. It was a lot of work, and it's interesting to see how it's turned out. And it definitely is bittersweet for me to hear it and to remember it. And you know, I'm glad that it's people are being made aware of it. And when I saw it, like, you know, with Antifa movement, I definitely was like cheering all along. They're like, yeah, that's like what we started. We started that. I mean, it probably before us, but I really felt like we had a hand in starting some of that. So, I mean, I'm just glad to see it unfold and continuing to watch it unfold.
Mike, is there anything in that you want to comment on that before we move on to another question? You should feel free to jump in.
No, I think, you know, just really reinforcing there's so much, you know, that comes up, but if I could whittle it down to some of the more profound points, it is that we were able to do something that was relevant to us mm-hmm. at that time. And it's still relevant. And this podcast, the process of creating It Did Happen Here, has given us an opportunity to once again be in community. Mm. You know, we get in capitalism, as individuals, we get so compartmentalized in our commitment and responsibility and obligations to do everything to, you know, provide access to the basic necessities. And a lot of times the collective activity that we engaged in our youth is something that it almost seems impractical to continue to work collectively, you know? And so I'm just recognizing and reflecting on the fact that it does take a collective, you know, to do impactful work.
I think that's one of the things listening to the podcast, you know, listeners hear about so many of the different individuals, but also organizations. And so that word collective is really hitting with me right now, thinking about the, you know, there were parts of the podcast talking about how different groups work together, even if they didn't agree on tactics or work to support each other's priorities, you know, at different times. And so I'm interested in hearing, you know, any more that you want to say about that. And also to hear about some of the ways that oppression showed up in the scene, you know, whether that's misogyny or other types of oppression as well. And China, you had brought that up in one of our planning calls. So I don't know if you want to take that on first, but thinking about those, you know, any of the sort of conflict within the scene and also that that collective action within the scene.
Sure, I can speak to that. So I think when at the time, I just saw it as a group of young people kind of all united against a common evil, so to speak. And, you know, I did realize that there was like when some organizers came in to kind of back us, I guess is how I would describe it, that this was this is hierarchical. And I guess we were the people on the street, the people putting our bodies on the line. You know, so like I remember the first anti-racist action meeting, and I remember I was really excited that, you know, this was part of a larger framework. And I was a kid, you know, and I understand, you know, sometimes you understand things as a kid, but you don't kind of see the big picture till you're an adult, you know. So I think I was there, but I was excited that to be a part of that meeting and like, hey, this is actually going somewhere. We're not just here like, you know, street fighting, because the police really tried to, you know, just portray us as a gang. And, you know, like, I remember once the police stopped me and they didn't know if I was a Crip. It sounds so dumb. They didn't know if I was a Crip or Blood or skinhead. I mean, none of those, you know, but that's kind of where they categorized what we were doing. And we were really fighting something that we knew was deeply wrong, you know, just on a deep level. And as far as oppression, I mean, I just think back to that time. I was talking to some other friends that were around at that time, and we were just talking about kind of the scene, the whole kind of, I guess I use the word misogyny, because it was really, there were people that were working for justice. We were all kind of united, but then there was all this kind of abuses going on towards guys and their girlfriends and different kind of like, you know, which is, you know, it's indicative of the larger movement. There's always, you know, the fight for justice and then the kind of the internal fight for doing justice. So I think there were, you know, there was definitely, like, I remember people talk about going gay bashing just in the punk scene. And I remember, you know, just how violent and sickening, and people talking about how they would, you know, team up on, you know, girls and women. And that was a reality of the space that we're in. And I think we were building kind of the consciousness that these things are wrong. Cause I remember, you know, helping friends that had been assaulted, and, you know, just dealing with this kind of, like, you know, you think teenagers are just dealing with, like, high school broken hearts. We were dealing with people that had been assaulted and that were, you know, afraid, even within the anti-racist scene, prior to, you know, the anti-racism, but there was the punk rock scene was pretty racist. And whenever you have racism, you have misogyny. So that kind of goes together. And then I think, but slowly the, you know, and I think it should be noted that it was a group of kids, you know, it wasn't, they were older people, but it was a kids movement. So as far as the stuff that we're doing, you know, you make mistakes as a kid. I think that is important, but I think we were building a consciousness.
I would love to just, you know, add on a little bit and say that we always have to, you know, I'm a radical, right? So when I identify as a radical, I was taught by elder radicals and revolutionaries that what that means is that you're always going to look for the root cause, and that the root of being radical is to eradicate, so that when we want to remove a weed from the garden, we don't just, you know, pick off the leaves or the stems. We actually have to go under and uproot it from the bottom. And so with the radical perspective is going to be one that allows me to understand the broader context. You know, we exist in white supremacist, heteronormative, capitalist patriarchy. It's a product of our history and is not separate from it. And so the dominant culture is one that has defined so much of what we think of ourselves and how we see each other. What I will say is that even though a lot of the oppression that is an aspect of the broader dominant culture, is first of all inescapable. In mainstream society, it exists. Okay. In subcultural, radical expressions, those same things are there. We're still struggling with the same issues that broader society struggles with. So we're seeing people act out homophobia. We're seeing people act out racism. We're seeing people act out misogyny in the punk scene too. But one of the things that the punk scene did provide was a space for those of us who were radical or becoming more radical to assert the questions of, like, how do we become better? And how do we root this out of our own behavior? How do we confront and be accountable for what it's actually going to take to make a better society or a better community? And if we have to fight, we're going to fucking fight, you know? And so, like, that's something that it's messy, but that was part of what we were doing. And that's something that wasn't present in the mainstream society.
Absolutely, Mike. I totally agree with everything you're saying. And, you know, I observed the same thing. Yep.
There's a review of the podcast that Hagendorf, wrote for The Life Harvester. And I'm going to read a quote from it and then just see if you all want to comment on it further. He wrote, "For the collective behind It Did Happen Here, there is no question that fascism can only be met with force. What's different about the perspective offered is that many of the subjects, teens when they were fighting neo-Nazis in the streets, are in or approaching middle age. And they have had time to reflect on the personal toll that participating in that violence has taken on them and their friends." So that's the quote from the review. And I wanted to ask Mike and China if you want to comment on that, or if there's anything else that you want to say about violence in this history and your relationship with that.
Okay, I'll speak on it. I mean, I think I've heard writers put to words what I felt but didn't have the words, that being Black in America meant violence. I mean, our bodies in a sense are, you know, a site for violence, and violence, I mean, there's really no way to escape violence if you are one way or another, if you are a Black person in America. I mean, I don't want to make that true. And being a mother, I hate to see that. And, you know, that's what we have worked. I felt like, man, I was out there fighting and, you know, really working towards something. And it's to this day, we're still seeing, you know, violence enacted upon people, marginalized people. And it's, you know, violence is, you know, I hate when people talk about nonviolence and all this kind of rhetoric, but ignore the massive violence that, you know, our whole country is built on and stays in power because of. Okay, that's big to say, but you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, just on a personal level, it's something that, you know, really working to kind of sort out what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, and having to reconcile the violence and manage it. And, you know, when you think about raising kids, you don't want to raise kids in a violent space and a violent mindset. So I think there's been a lot of personal work I've had to do to, you know, cause we're like soldiers out there. I mean, you know, Mike, no, you know, when you're out there, you're like a soldier, and, you know, it's a shift to be a mother and a community member and to take those steps, to find inner peace and also hold that, you know, not hold yourself like respond. I mean, there's different levels, but I came to the point where I was like, I did what I needed to do, and I'm not sorry for what I did. Violence, I would have died if I didn't fight back.
That's so real, you know, being middle-aged and having a family, there's a lot more to lose. Being a young person with a big heart, I was ready to do whatever it took, but I didn't value my life as much as I do now. And that the question of the value of life really becomes, it's a hard thing to kind of weigh, because we ask when how much of this construct of what it means to be responsible and successful and to have a nuclear family, and how much of that is real, and how much of it is somebody else's ideal that's imposed upon us? How often do we get to really like critically deconstruct these things in meaningful ways? The process of looking at what we've accepted as reality and the standard is a violent process intellectually, because in order to question what we've accepted as normal, we have to really reconcile in our own consciousness the fact that this nation was built on genocide that continues. You know, we talk about First Nations, Indigenous, and Native American people often as if they're a historical relic. But when I look at some of my friends who are in the streets daily right now fighting, I have a friend who, you know, has been in the streets so much amidst the tear gas that they feel that they miscarried because of the impact of the different gases and stuff that the police and the feds were using on the populace. So this is an ongoing struggle. And in order for the status quo to exist, there's unthinkable, unimaginable violence that is always being waged against masses of human beings. So when I look at my kid, I don't want them to have to fight. I don't want them to have to get hurt. But I'm always asking these questions of like, what can I share based on my experience that I can pass along to my child in a way that doesn't sugarcoat things, that doesn't censor things, in a way that arms them for what this world is actually based on. But yeah, I don't want the police knocking on my door. I don't want people hunting me down. And that's part of what was happening back then. You know, I would hate to be in a parking lot at a store with my family and have a car full of neo-Nazis, you know, pull up and jump out with weapons. But that was part of what used to happen. So I just, you know, it's a question. What I will say is that as an adult, a middle-aged adult with a family, I don't want to throw my life away. I don't want to kill. I don't want to take another person's life. I don't want to wind up having to do decades in prison for defending my right to exist and defending my politics. But I'm glad that I have the life experience that lets me know that if and when those circumstances arise, that I know what to do.
Thanks a lot to you both. I really appreciate that so much about what you said, but I think really that call to be thoughtful about the ways that the structures surround us are so deeply violent so much of the time and have been, you know, in our state and our nation for such a long time is just such an important reminder for thinking about the context of the history that you tell and the work that you all did that's told in the podcast. So I really appreciate that. And I just would, you know, invite, you know, if there's more that folks want to say about that to please do. And I know that, you know, there's two episodes of the podcast that are dedicated to the stories of individual people who were, you know, Mulugeta Sarah, one of them who did die as part of this, and then John Bear, who was involved in another death as part of this. And I'm interested, you know, from all of you talking about, to hear you talk about those deaths and those incidents, and then also, you know, Aaron and Selena and whoever was involved in the decision to dedicate those two episodes to those individual people's lives, and to talk some about the decision and how you went about that as well. So whoever wants to take it, I'll toss it open.
I can speak to that, at least starting. The Mulugeta Sarah was definitely the, his killing was the flashpoint of getting people who weren't doing this fight to pay attention to what was actually happening in more of a way like, oh, you know, it's not just a punk scene problem or, okay, you know, this is real. This is like the highest circumstances. But the decision to focus on Mulugeta as much as we could of him as a human and as a person, so many, I think, storytelling or reporting or journalist takes on hate crimes or violence focuses on the people who do the violence. And one of the main values I think that we had as producers being part of it is that this is not about the white supremacists. You can hear the mainstream story. You can hear the police version of story. You can hear these other versions of the story somewhere else, but you have not heard the story of the people experiencing the violence and fighting back against the violence. So to there was a 30th anniversary memorial for Mulugeta's death, and there was a conference around it. I can't remember who the sponsors were now, I'm sorry. And then that's when the street signs went up in the Kearns neighborhood on top. There's one of the images of, I think the last episode of the podcast has his birth and death days and photos of him in there all over that particular neighborhood. So we wanted to just more focus on the life that he did have and the impact that he did have as a human. And as for John Bear, I think if you do know the story, the shortcut version is there's a bunch of boneheads around, they killed Mulugeta Sarah, everybody got pissed, we kicked their asses, John Bear killed somebody, and then it was over. So if you're gonna just have the sweeping 5-minute story, then that's what it is. So it also seemed important to try to tell the quote end unquote in a more nuanced way. And then John just was so vulnerable and open and powerful about his experiences that it just was like, this is the beauty of the podcast is that It's not, it doesn't have to fit into column space or, you know, a particular broadcast time. It has to be 58 minutes. You know, podcasts can be however long they need to be. And so that's just, after he told that story, like, that's just what needs to happen. You know, the content just spoke for the necessity of that space for that story to be told.
I want to just contribute that, you know, the opportunity to reconnect with people who I knew back then, many of whom I remain close with. John Bear is one of those people. But there's an overwhelming sensation of, I don't think joy is the appropriate word, but I think there's a lot of gratitude that people we've interviewed have been expressing. Because a lot of these people have been sitting with these stories, you know, for decades. And a lot of these people are pretty humble. And so for them to be able to tell their stories and have it be relevant and impactful has been really like empowering for a lot of people.
Ask some more about that work of building trust. Selena, were you about to speak on that? Please go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to piggyback off of what Aaron had said about having the space and also focusing on the humanity, because it's so easy to hear a name and kind of in one ear and out the other this day and age. And so to focus on that, these are real people with real lives.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the things we talked about in preparation was the work of building trust with people. You know, Mike, you were saying that a lot of these folks have been really humble and have been appreciative of the opportunity to tell their stories and contribute to this. And I think also there's, there is some danger also, as you're, you know, have been talking about as well. And so if you all would want to talk some about the process of what it was like to reach out to people, how you connected with networks to bring folks into the process of being interviewed and participate in this, and sort of how you went about that to gather the group, that would be great.
I don't want to talk too much, so it's easy to talk a lot. I did want to produce a podcast about the experience of being a Black skinhead specifically. And I was having trouble getting it off the ground. Just because, you know, a lot of commitments, very little time. And around that time, Aaron approached me and said, hey, you know, there's potentially some resources that KBLU has to do a podcast about the anti-racist activism that intersects with the stories of what you're trying to work on. And without that conversation, I would have never been compelled to go, okay, I'm gonna commit, you know, and stop procrastinating and stop putting things on the back burner, you know. And I was able to go, now knowing that there was material support for the project and for the effort, I was able to go reach out to people with a greater sense of determination and certainty about what was going to happen. But during that process, the outcome of what manifested as the It Did Happen Here podcast far exceeded what I imagined.
Excuse me. And as Mike went out into the world to collect stories from his people, his community, I started working on it in town. And a lot of the building's trust was like, you know, Mike and I had built trust over just being friends for years. And so when I could call up these people or just say, like, I'm working with Mike Crenshaw, they're like, great, I have no idea who you are. It doesn't, you're with Mike, it's great. So So Mike just did a lot of the trust building in that initial, just his life experience by being an amazing human and like community member. And there was another with John Bear, it was another friend of our friend Doug, who I've known for 30 years. And he's like, oh, you're friends with Doug and you're working on this with Mike. Yes, I'll come in. And then once he had the experience with me, then he's like, okay, I will give you someone else's number. And then that person, you know, it's like, okay, once people actually got to know me, they were more open about sharing their community, because these people are very protective of each other for obvious reasons now that you've all heard the podcast. So it's really was relying on Mike's community building to get the fighters especially to talk to us. Part of KBOO's resources was being able to have folks do some of the interviews with us and to be able to pay Selena for her time actually also tracking people down and doing the same thing for more of the CHD connected people. And you could speak to that, Selena, more than I can, for sure.
It was kind of a domino effect in a way. So that once it was really being able to find Abby Layton on Facebook, and she really connected us to so many people in the CHD. And there, Jonathan Mizaki in particular was very conscientious about vetting, and it helped to have KBOO to reference and be able to say, like, there's this organization behind us, and also just to be persistent and to kind of convey the gravity of what we're working on and why their knowledge and experience was so important to record and share.
Can you give us some examples of some of those folks that you reached out to? And sort of, Selena, I think maybe you learned about this history maybe later than everybody else involved in it. So can you talk some about how you came to learn about this and what it was like to sort of put the pieces together in your head as you began interviewing more people and learning more? And what resources other than people you maybe went to learn more of this history? So,
well, it really did not all come together in my mind until the episodes were, sorry, that's my cat sneezing, if you heard that. It didn't all really come together in my mind until I heard the episodes. And because interviewing people and having this list of questions and even receiving the answers, it was kind of this disembodied, non-contextual information. And hearing it in the actual episodes with the narration and with the other, like the fighters' interviews, I was like, oh, this is so important and this makes so much sense. Maybe that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. It's like some writers say that they don't really know what they want to say, that you have to do the process of the writing until you understand what your point is. You don't know before you start working on it. Yeah.
It was really cool to see it unfold.
Yeah. I'm imagining your whiteboard behind you, Aaron, with being a like puzzle of trying to put it all together.